inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. Welcome back, those of you who have been listening. I just got the stats from April. I don't know how many of you have been listening consistently, but 1,100 and some of you listened in February, and then 25 and some listened in March, but 9,561 people listened in April. So if you are one of them, I'm really happy to have you, and I hope that I will continue to be giving you something that you want. And if you're not one of them but have somehow found me, that's terrific, and welcome. As you know, if you've been listening, I think it's important for me to say at the beginning of the show what you can expect. And so if you've heard it before, I'm sorry. I say also every time that this is new information for most people, and new information, we need to hear it a lot. So what I do in this show is I talk about the concepts in my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, and is all about why we can't do what we want to do when we want to do it. I'm a psychotherapist and have run into this problem over and over with my clients who come because there is either something they want to do that they or have not been able to do, or something they want to stop doing that they can't seem to stop doing. And because they are at the mercy of the, quote, conventional wisdom, unquote, which says that if you only just wanted it enough and you tried hard enough, that you would be able to do it. And I don't believe that's true. I believe that when you have wanted something and have tried and still haven't been able to do it or stop doing it, that there's a really good reason. There's a valid reason. There's an obstacle that's getting between you and what you want to do. And that as long as you're not looking for the reason, but just looking to try and force yourself to do this thing, you may not have success. Whereas if you stop trying to change it, do it, fix it, be it, and look for the obstacle, you have a really good opportunity to tackle that obstacle and then do the thing you want to do. So up until now, I've been talking about the obstacle created by our family of origin. And if you're not one of the 9,561 people who've been listening and you're curious about that, you could go up on my website. They have just made it possible for you to listen to those shows, the early shows. You just click on the podcast and listen to the show. Unfortunately, I went up today and discovered that many of the really early shows, the 1 through 6, for some reason, they are not available yet. They're up there, but you can't hear them. That is, you click on download and nothing happens. But I have gotten in touch with the web guys, and I am hopeful that maybe even by now they'll be up there. So if you have any curiosity about what I've been talking about until now, please go up. Oh, website, thelinshow.com. And that's L-Y-N-N-E, The Lynn Show, one word. And if you don't put the E, you'll get a different Lynn. So if you want this one, you have to add the E to my name. Okay, so I'm done for the most part talking about the family, although the family will pop up in everything I talk about. What I'm going to do now is move on to the concept of danger. Danger as it exists in change. Because we have this culture that says, you know, just do it. And if at first you don't succeed, try again, and certainly then you will succeed. We are reluctant to recognize that there's a danger attached to the change that we want to make. We're reluctant to accept the fact that if we make this change, we will be letting ourselves in for some kind of danger which doesn't exist at the moment. Now, of course, the danger of your discontent, of your unhappiness, of your frustration at not being able to do what you want to do, that's very, very real. But I believe and have seen confirmed over and over again that if there's something that you want to do and you've not been able to make yourself do it, then it's because you anticipate a larger danger. Perhaps a danger you are not sure you can endure. So this show and the following shows are all going to be dedicated to exploring the area of danger and how that influences our ability to make change. The other thing that I do in the shows is I interview people, and I'm in the middle of a series called Anatomy of an Artist, where I've been interviewing people. I was going to say human beings, but really, well, there were animals that made their living in the arts. Woof, woof, never mind. I've been interviewing people who have made their living as artists. This is a tricky business. Our culture is not, in my experience, that friendly to artists. And so I've been interviewing those, some of them, who have actually been able to do it. In this show, and in the following shows as well, I'm going to interview couples who have made their living individually in their respective arts. In this show, I'm interviewing Carolyn Michael, an extraordinarily talented actor who has made her home in Sarasota, Florida, and has appeared in every venue here and in every possible kind of role. And not only here, and you'll hear her talk about her career, which has been extensive. And her husband of 7 years, Howard Millman, who is not only a director and has been an actor, but also the savior of many theaters, most currently the Oslo Theater in Sarasota, Florida, which he rescued now for the second time. So I've interviewed Carolyn and then Howard and then the two of them. But as often happens to me, these interviews go on longer than I have time for. So I'm going to take the time to play Carolyn's interview and Howard's interview, and then either next week or at some time in the future, I'm going to play the interview of the two of them. they're delightful. It was such a pleasure for me to interview them, and I know that you're going to enjoy listening to them. So we're going to start with Carolyn, and here she is. So I'm sitting here with Carolyn Michael, who...
Do you mind if I take off my shoes?
Not at all.
And then if I put my feet up on the surface, like, would that be bad?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
For some reason, I can't sit with my feet straight.
That's okay.
Yeah. Oh, good. Okay, so here I am with Carolyn Michael in her home, which is very beautiful and on St. Armand's Circle. And I don't know if I told you, I don't actually have an agenda for these interviews. I don't have questions. Like, I like them to evolve wherever they're going to evolve from. So in all the time that I know you, you have been, well, maybe one of the most versatile actors I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Well, my God.
That's a very nice way to start out the interview. I like that.
Well, you've done everything.
Well, I started out I started out in kindergarten raising my hands as a tulip.
As a tulip?
So I started
like this, you mean two hands up?
Two hands up. So I started out playing a tulip, and people applauded, and I really liked that. And then later on, I went to a girls' school, and I played the boys' roles because I was dark-haired and sort of a character actress even then. Wow. I played all the boys' roles. And so I had an early start of playing men and plants. And
variety.
And when I was 12, I played the mother in A Bird's Christmas Carol at the little drama school I went to.
Did you grow up?
I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri. And I did drama. I went to a drama school, and I also took a lot of dance. And I was a very shy little girl, so it was a way that I could express myself in a controlled way. I found that I had an ability to do this, and it brought me attention. And I was felt more comfortable on stage than I did interacting in my real life. And a lot of performers say that it's not, you know, people are always shocked that performers are shy, but
yeah.
Essentially, there are a lot of us who are shy and then have these sort of other skills that we bring to the table. So yeah, I grew up as a shy little girl in St. Louis, Missouri, and went to theater school and danced a lot, went to dancing school, and then at the Temple, I instead of studying Hebrew, I was in the dramatics class and I played Pincus Pinocchio in the Purim play. So another boy's role, but nevertheless a leading role, so I liked it.
Yeah.
And there you go.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother and a sister. They're both older than I am. And my sister was they were both actually interested in theater. My brother, in fact, cast me as Pincus Pinocchio in the Purim play at Temple. And my sister went to Pasadena Playhouse. They never pursued it as professionals. I did.
Pasadena Playhouse in California?
In California, that Pasadena Playhouse.
When she grew up?
Yes. Right out of high school. I mean, she was right out of high school and went there for a summer.
And then
auditioned for the Neighborhood Playhouse and then decided to get married because that's what she really wanted to do.
Yeah. Okay, so it's sort of in the family.
Yes, my mother was a pianist. My father was an artist who translated his skills into the advertising business. And when I was a little girl, they took me to symphonies and plays, and I loved it. I loved it from the very second I first saw Mary Martin fly across the stage.
Yeah.
I went, oh.
Yeah.
So...
And so your parents, I mean, I guess they were okay with all of these little actors running around. I mean, they didn't discourage any of you. They didn't say...
Well, my brother never really did it. He played in theater when we were young. No, they encouraged all the creativity in the house, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they ever thought that any of us would go into it professionally, although they thought maybe my sister would because she did go to Pasadena Playhouse and got into the Neighborhood Playhouse, as I said, but then didn't pursue it. So they were supportive when I pursued it.
So then what did you do? I mean,
I graduated high school. After I graduated the girls' school, and in the later years, I actually got to play women. I think my first female role was Anne Frank in The Diary of Anne Frank when I was a sophomore. And so that was like one that catapulted me to stardom in my high school. And then I went on to be able to play the leading roles from then on in school. And then I went to Boston University and trained and got my Bachelor of Fine Arts in acting and got serious training and good training, very good training that has stood me in good stead my entire career. Very good basic skills to be a professional.
I'm just curious, You're not shy now.
Well, I consider myself shy
now. Do
you? I consider myself a shy person who has developed good skills to compensate. So
yeah.
So I don't know. I don't. But inside, I feel shy.
You still feel like
even
though
shy.
The behavior, you don't.
Right.
You don't come across as a shy person.
Right. 400 years later.
Well, but it's interesting. I mean, are you really a shy person? Or are you no longer a shy person, but you feel like what?
I think I am still a shy person. I don't think that it's just an old perception. I think that I feel that's who I really am. And I think it's based on the fact that I'm very, very vulnerable and very sensitive. And most people don't see that in me either.
Yeah.
Most people see my coping skills and my take charge skills those sorts of things. But I am extremely sensitive. And so there's a part of me that is so... that I protect.
You have to protect, right. And actually, those skills...
And people would want me to, because they wouldn't want to see this, you know, sort of blubbering, sensitive person. Oh, my God, what's wrong with her? So...
I'm not sure that's true. But in fact, you have... You certainly use that on stage.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
You find, you let her...
She gets...
that's right.
Okay, you get to play now.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. So actually, I mean, you've done... some extraordinary stuff with yourself. I mean, you have become able to do a whole range of behaviors whenever they're appropriate.
Well, that's the joy of being an actor is that you get to experience all facets of being a human.
Right.
Because you do things on stage that you wouldn't do in real life. You know, we play murderers, we play liars,
dogs.
I play the dog. Yes, and we play all sorts of wonderful facets of humanity or the animal kingdom, but even that dog was meant to be sort of human. That was, we're talking about the Gurney play called Sylvia, and that was a great experience playing that play. And that she was meant to be sort of the other woman in the play, a real cute, dog, streetwise dog.
Okay, so from that first moment, did you always want to do this? Was there something else you wanted to do?
I never wanted to do anything. So at one point, I thought maybe I'd dance because as a child I danced. But somewhere deep inside, I don't think even on a conscious level, but unconsciously, I knew that I wasn't ever going to be good enough to be a professional dancer. I was a move weller. I dance really, really well, but because I don't have much extension and I have flat feet, and I sort of didn't have
the body for it.
I was like great from the waist up. So somewhere along the line, I think unconsciously, when I was in high school, really, I knew that my skills would take me farther as an actor than a dancer. And so I loved dancing, and I always dance, and I still do. But I knew that I would never be good. I would never be as good as you need to be. And so I easily transitioned out of that desire and kept wanting to be an actor. And so I went to Boston University, and then I went to New York and studied some more and you know, knocked around New York trying to get little off Broadway jobs and try to knock on doors. And, you know, I was putting my picture and resume under agents' doors. You couldn't even, like, see them. You would have to walk around to these big buildings and shove your picture and resume under the door. It was so humiliating and terrible. And, I mean, I remember once I went to a cattle call for some show like No, 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 Net kind of thing where you had to dress up in, you know, sort of little 20s things and tap. And I thought, oh, I'll dress like this. And I did. And, of course, I went there and there were 400 young girls, cute young girls like myself.
Dressed like this.
Dressed like that. I got lucky and I did a bunch of summer stock and started to, in addition to, you know, having had my Boston University training and now my New York training, I did some summer stock and got some practical training, and then I started to get little jobs in dinner theaters. And dinner theater, it became, in those days, dinner theater was really the training ground. You could. In earlier days, it was summer stock, and summer stock was sort of on its way out in my era, and dinner theater was in, and it was a great training ground for us because you really could go from theater to theater and do good work, and I joined the union by that time, and so I was able to sort of learn and grow, and with each new experience. And then I worked for I've been a vacationed here in Sarasota, Florida, for I had vacationed here with my parents when I was a young girl, and then they bought a house here when I was a young girl, and so I would come back and forth from New York to here. Ultimately, I met Bob Turoff, who runs Golden Apple Dinner Theater, and he gave me a job in Butterflies Are Free and George M. And I think my first show was You Know I Can't Hear You When the Water's Running, and then Mary Mary with him. So I did those four shows in one season for him and was so happy to be in this environment and working. And I kept going back and forth between California and New York and here, and California and New York and here, and working, and, you know. And then around several years later, Bob Turoff gave me an opportunity to direct. So I directed for him, and then I met Sid Caesar and worked with him in a play and directed him in a play, or I should say negotiated. Didn't really direct him, I just negotiated the piece.
What about this, Sid?
Yeah.
Oh, Sid.
Exactly. So from that relationship, Sid Caesar and I have had a remarkable friendship for all these years. We first met in 1976 when I was a tot in the business. And so it's been marvelous. We've worked together for many, many years. I was on Broadway with him when he took a review to Broadway in 1989. And I also, the last thing I did with him, which I think is the last thing he did other than doing some, you know, sort of guest Kennedy Center appearances, was in Los Angeles at the Alex Theater in Glendale, where we performed Beethoven's Fifth Symphony with a symphony orchestra as a husband and wife argument. Oh. And it's a sketch that he did initially with Ninette Fabre, and then he put it in his act, and I did it with him. And Imogene Coca had also done it with him.
I think I've even seen it. I think I saw it.
It's on YouTube now.
Yeah, I think I saw it in one of those retrospectives. With Imogene Coca, I think.
You must have seen it with Nanette, because Imogene did it the way I did it in later life. She didn't do it. The original was done with Nanette Fabre.
Maybe
Nanette
that's
Fabre.
What I saw.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's an amazing piece.
Yeah.
It's great.
So that's one of those sort of wonderful adventures you have in life. Sid Caesar is a wonderful comic genius.
How old is he now?
I never remember how old he is. He's in his 80s, and he's great. He's frail now, but he's mentally certainly all there. And
is he still in L.A.?
He is still living in his home in L.A., where he's lived for many, many years with his wife, Florence, who's just fabulous, and they've been together forever.
Wow.
So my career has taken me in many, many diverse areas.
Am I hearing that you wound up more and more in Sarasota? Is that what happened?
That's what happened. And so I sort of made a passive move here because I kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And then ultimately I just sort of never left. And I was having all these opportunities, both directing and acting. And so I stayed. It was the best thing I could have done for myself without even making it a conscious decision. I sort of followed my heart, as it were. Mm-hmm. And it was...
Or your feet.
My feet, yeah. or the jobs, as it were.
Yeah, right.
So I love living in Sarasota. I think it's a beautiful place to live, and it's a terrific arts community. And right now I'm directing, I just finished my 17th season at the Oslo Theater, and I've worked at Florida Studio Theater a lot. Last summer I did a one-person play where I played Ann Landers, and now I'm directing for the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. A play opens this tonight as we speak, Aunt Rudell's Family Reunion. Mm-hmm. And I'm directing a play reading in Florida Studio Theater's new play festival next week. And then I'm taking the summer off because I really want a break. But and then I'm coming back to be in the Oslo Repertory Company, which is something that when I was a kid, I used to go to the Oslo and watch the plays. And I thought, someday I want to be good enough to be able to be on that stage and do that. And so I really didn't even know really consciously that it was, I thought that, but I also thought, well, I want to be a big TV star too. But, you think that too. But I think that I did fulfill my own personal dream about being able to be here and have a life as a theater artist and have a life and challenge myself with all these different roles. So I've had tremendous opportunities, and it's been a joy and a blessing. And then I met my wonderful husband.
Yes.
I just got married 7 years ago, and I'm no spring chicken.
You waited a long time to get married.
I did wait a long time to get married. I think I got messages from my mother to do what you need to do. And I was in that transition generation, as you were,
uh-huh.
That we were the ones who were sort of the groundbreakers for now you can sort of have it all. But we were the people who were trying to have the career and not necessarily following a husband around from place to place. And so I wanted to be free to do that. And
well, this is interesting.
My idea of a husband was, oh, I have to follow him from place to place. Now, that's probably not true, but that was my idea of what a husband was. So I sort of avoided doing that for all those years because I didn't want to, I was worried that I would give up too much of myself and what I wanted. I had relationships. I had great relationships, and I certainly, you know, had affairs with people and had a really good time. Mm-hmm. And then the right person came along in my life and made me marry him, and it was great.
But do you think that your sister would have liked to have had her career as well, or?
No, she did what she wanted to do. She really does not have any regrets, and neither do I. That's not true. I do regret, there's a part of me that still regrets the fact that I do not have my own child, because I think that as a woman, that's a life experience that, oops, I forgot to do that.
Yeah.
I do regret that. But then I think of all the carpooling and all of that, and then I go, oh, well, it's fine. And children don't always turn out to be exactly the fantasized image of what you would like them to be. And I have lovely nieces and nephews who are great friends of mine, and so they're my sort of surrogate children. I think nowadays people do manage to balance it out and do both. I think you can. I think it's hard, and I know a lot of people, a lot of actors and actresses who do not have children because they did what I did, which is they became dedicated to roaming around the country,
yeah,
playing in plays like a traveling minstrel,
yeah, a gypsy.
Mm-hmm. But the reality is I have not been a gypsy for many years. I've lived in Sarasota now basically for many years, and I travel every now and then to do plays, but not that much. Mostly I work in this vicinity.
Here. And you want to talk a little bit about your commitment to causes?
Sure. Well, I have found that in order to not be totally selfish and a total crazy person, it has been my great joy to be involved in a number of charitable endeavors that bring more to my life than I bring to the charities. But it's a great outlet. It's a great way to feel that you're contributing to the world. And that's one of the other great things about living here in Sarasota is that you really can have an impact on the community. And you can see your impact in the community because it's a small enough place and yet it's an enlightened enough place to be able to enlist people to follow your dream, to follow your cause, to put together a big AIDS benefit. I've done AIDS benefits for 20 years when it was starting in 1987 when it wasn't so popular or known to do that. And so I've been involved in doing AIDS benefits, and I've been involved in the Boys and Girls Club, and I've been involved in all the arts organizations and the Arts Council and Planned Parenthood and you name it. I've sort of been involved in it, in all the major causes. Not AIDS is probably the only disease I've been involved in.
It occurs to me that is a way that you spend that what might otherwise be maternal energy.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good point.
You caretake.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, I do. And I get to use my, I usually do it in terms of using my theatrical skills to produce events and shows that will benefit organizations. So I, at the same time as I get to play in my own kind of sandbox, I get to benefit an organization or organizations at the same time. And that's extraordinarily
lucky.
Rewarding.
Yeah, it is.
Very rewarding. And it also gives me a sense of myself that is not solely related to having to do plays in order to feel like I'm a person. You know, it gives me a larger sense of myself because I interact in the community. I have more to do. I once asked Babe Wyler, who was this terrific woman who died in her sleep when she was 94 years old.
I know who she was.
And she
the yoga.
Yeah, right? She taught yoga up until, like, you know, the day before she died kind of thing. And I once asked her, what's your secret? You have such a positive attitude, and you're so great, and you're so healthy. And she said, it's very important to stay involved with something outside of yourself. Very important to be involved in. She went and taught yoga, and she volunteered at one of the thrift shops. And that's what she said. And I think she's right.
Mm-hmm. I do, too.
I think she's right. I think that it's very important to make sure that you have projects, as Billis says in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. I like to have projects.
But I also think that the projects have to have meaning for you.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's clear to me that pretty much everything you do has meaning to you.
Yes, I can't do it unless I can sort of get emotionally behind it.
It's a kind of integrity.
I hope so. I hope so. I try to live a life of integrity. I think integrity is very, very important. And at the end of the day, I have to go to sleep with myself. And so my own integrity is very important to me, which is not to say I'm a saint, because I do, you know, little things like anybody else. But I do endeavor.
I think
And I'm plagued by that. When I do feel like I've fudged on something or cheated on, it's not cheat, I don't cheat, but, you know, cheat in my own mind.
Yeah,
cheat.
Not lived up somehow
not lived
to
up
your
to
own,
my own
standards.
Yeah, that I torture myself a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I want to tell you that that's clear and that it's lovely.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. I think this is a personal opinion based on what's important to me, but I think integrity is underrated and underused.
Clearly, in our society, I think it is.
Yeah, and so it's really, it's lovely to see, you know, that it's not, it's like, you know, it's not out of date. And you know, I think that must be at least part of why you're so good at what you do.
Oh, you're very sweet. I don't know. I do know that I'm out there endeavoring every day to sort of be the best person I can be. And some days I'm could see, succeed more at that than other days, you know.
Well, but I think skill can only take you just so far as an actor, and that authenticity is really what makes the difference, what makes a person believable on stage, not just that they have, you know, good training and good skills. And you have all of that, Carolyn.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for this.
It's great talking with you.
Yeah, always. Is there anything you would like to say? Is there anything you would like to plug? Is there anything we can do for you?
Well, I hope people will come. I hope people will buy tickets to all the theaters.
and
come to the theater.
And support the theater.
And support the theater and see live theater. There's nothing like the interaction between an audience and the people on stage, and it's way different from watching a movie, because the people on stage are live, and there's a synergy that happens between the live actors and the live people in the audience that's different every single performance, and there's nothing like it. So I encourage people to buy subscriptions to theaters, to all theaters. Mm-hmm. Of course, people can't see all plays all the time, but I am currently appearing at the Oslo Repertory in, you know, season after season, and I love Florida Studio Theater, and I encourage people to attend the West Coast Black Theater Troupe. And if they like musicals, the Golden Apple Dinner Theater is doing some terrific musicals, so go to the theater.
Go to the theater, indeed. Thank you, Carolyn.
Thank you, Lynn.
That was my interview with the absolutely adorable Carolyn Michael. You can see how much I enjoyed it. And coming up is my interview with the equally adorable Howard Millman. And you will see it again, how much I enjoyed it and why I'm so happy to do this. I also did an interview with the two of them, which I would love to play back-to-back with these two, but there's just not enough time. So I will do that in the near future. And after my interview with Howard, I will talk a little bit more about danger and how fear of danger gets between us and what we want to do. But before I get to that, the undangerous and quite delightful Howard Millman.
Now I'm sitting here with Howard Millman, who is the wonderful husband of Carolyn Michael.
Thank you.
And we don't know each other. So for me, this will be all about learning. Do you want to tell me something about... Well, maybe I'll ask it this way. What is it that you would like to be talking about? What is it that you would like to say about yourself and your life as an artist? And
my life as an artist has taken a lot of strange turns. I mean, I'm of a generation that when you went into the theater, you didn't do what they do today. Actors, for instance, and directors take advanced degrees with professional programs in universities such as the Oslo has.
Right.
Carolyn's day and my day, we didn't do that. I mean, I do have a master's, and I have all the work for my PhD. I have a PhD called ABD, you know, all but dissertation. But I did all of that. But the intention was never really to get those degrees to then go into professional acting or directing. In those days, you got those degrees so that...
You could teach if you had to.
Teach if you could back it up.
Yeah, right.
And my career took interesting turns. I started out as an actor in a very small school in upstate New York called Hartwick College. I think we had a total of maybe 600 in the entire school.
Wow. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brooklyn. I'm a Brooklyn boy.
Ah. Yeah. Well, I'm a Queens girl.
Are you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm a Brooklyn boy. Went to Tilden High School in Brooklyn. Always loved the theater and the movies and secretly desired to do it and was petrified to tell my parents that's what I wanted to do.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister. She's 6 years younger than I am.
So you're the oldest boy in a Jewish family?
I am the oldest boy in a Jewish family. I'm the prince.
You're the prince.
Yes,
I know you are. Yeah. But still, shouldn't you be a dentist or something?
Well, it's interesting. When I told my father that, I guess it was at the end of my freshman year in college, that I was going to switch from pre-law to the theater.
Oh, my God.
He said, what kind of shingle can you hang outside your door?
Yeah.
And I justified it by saying, don't worry, I'll teach.
Yeah.
He didn't understand what it meant for me to go on to advanced degrees. He had no idea of that. He thought you go to college, you get out, and you go to work.
Are you first generation?
I'm definitely first generation.
Where did they come from?
Russia.
Ah.
Yeah. My father was 10 years old when he came here. My mother was 2 years old. She kept telling us she was 2 months old, but we found out after she died that she was 2 years old when she came here. She always lied at her age a couple of years. And all of my grandparents were alive, so I had all of the richness of that upbringing, you know, which I ran away from for so many years and then came pouring back to because it was so wonderful and rich and full and colorful. At any rate, I got out of undergraduate school and went to graduate school at Purdue University to take my master's, and then I got married right away.
Young.
Very young. You did that in those days.
Yeah.
I was 22 years old. 5 years later, I had a child, but in the meantime, I went into the Army.
Mm. When was that?
This was in 1953. I went into the Army.
Korea?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Did you fight?
Oh, I defended your nation's capital for 2 years. I was in an anti-aircraft battalion that ringed Washington, D.C. in case the Russians came over.
Oh, my God.
And in my second 8 weeks of basic training, we all expected to be sent to the second 8 weeks of infantry training and then to go over to Korea. But they go through the process of interviewing you. And they interviewed me, and they said, well, where do you want to go for your second 8 weeks? And I said, well, considering my background, I want to go to the Army Film School in Governor's Island, New York. And he said, you got to enlist for that. And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So he said, well, give me another choice. And I said, quartermaster school. I had no idea what quartermaster was.
But you figured it wasn't infantry.
It wasn't infantry, that's all. And I didn't expect to go. And the next thing I knew, I was assigned to Fort Lee, Virginia. I arrived on a weekend and wandered over to Special Services Office at Fort Lee before I started my training. Walked in the door when the corporal turned to the sergeant and said, who are we going to get to direct the big musical on post?
You're kidding. It's like a scene out of a movie.
Like a movie. It's like a movie. And I said, raise my hand. I said, here I am. And he said, who are you? And I told him. And, you know, how many directors with master's degrees walk through the door?
Yeah.
So he said, okay, but it was like community theater. You know, you finish your training, and then you worked until 2 o'clock in the morning doing the play. So I would get an average of maybe 4 hours sleep a night, nothing more. I would fall asleep in class. I learned nothing about the quartermaster, but I had a great show.
Yeah. And that's important.
I had a great show. And then was assigned to Washington, D.C., and while I was at Washington, D.C., I directed for a group called the Pentagon Players, and then I got out and taught high school for a couple of years. Oh, I actually did more than teach high school. I got out in mid-year. I got out in January, and my wife was then teaching. And so I got a job teaching English and history in a junior high school, and, you know, then I said, let's do a play. So I did Annie Get Your Gun. In those days, none of the schools ever did musicals. I mean, they was considered much too advanced for it. Today, the high schools all do them.
Right.
I did Annie Get Your Gun, and the people at the school, the superintendent's office, saw it. And so for the next 2 years, I had a job called dramatic consultant for Prince George's County, Maryland. I just went around and directed plays at the school.
Oh, my God.
I had a great time. Yeah. I had a great time.
Forgive me, but you seem to have a guardian angel.
Somewhere.
Yes, right. You're under the right star somehow.
That's right. And then I went to Florida State University in 1958 to take my doctorate at the urging of Dick Fallon, who had been my teacher in undergraduate school and who was my mentor. And he said, I've just gotten this job at Florida State University. Why don't you come and take your doctorate, which I did. And in 1959, we did a production of Clifford Odets' play The Country Girl, which is now on Broadway, by the way, with Morgan Freeman. And I was in it, and Issa Thomas, who just passed away, he was one of the great actresses in this community for years. And we brought it to the Oslo Theater.
The old one.
This is in the spring of 1959 for what they call the Arts Symposium Week. And at that point, they decided to, the Department of Theater, the Department of Speech it was in those days, decided to do a summer season with graduate students in that space in 1960. And that year, my mother passed away. She was very young. And I thought I was needed back home, which I wasn't. And so I didn't join them. But I got an interesting job after a year of teaching. I got an interesting job with the United States Army in Europe as what they call a civilian entertainment director, doing plays for the soldier and by the soldier. And it was there that I really discovered my managerial skills, because the Army didn't care about the quality of the work that you did. They just want to know that it ran well. And I like to run things. And then in 1961, we were in Germany for 3 years, and I wound up the assistant command director for all of Europe. I was 29 years old or something like that. It's ridiculous. And then I was asked to come back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, to take over a singing program, which I did, kind of built that up. And then Dick Fallon, they had then started the theater on a year-round basis in 1966 and 1968. He asked me to come and be the managing director at the Oslo Theater. And I said, I will, under one condition, that I direct plays, because managing directors don't direct,
they manage money.
They manage money. So I did that. From 1968 to 1980, I directed 14 plays in that old Oslo Theater. Nationally, the regional theater movement was just beginning to grow. And the problem was that I was very, very well known among my peers as a hot manager. And I didn't want to be a hot manager.
Yeah.
You know, I had 14 years of artistic work behind me, and I knew I had to leave to do that. To make a long story short, I wound up after a year and a half at the Pittsburgh Public Theater, which didn't work out for me. I wound up taking over a storefront theater in Rochester, New York in 1982. Called Jiva Theater, Genesee Valley Arts Foundation, Jiva Theater. And that was 1982, and by March of 1985, I opened a brand new 500-seat theater with 10,000 subscribers. So you can see from taking over the Oslo the first time when we were $250,000 in debt in 1968, and then going to Jiva and building that up, the kind of course my career took.
Yeah.
Which was building and saving theaters, you know. And those challenges were hugely exciting to me, you know, and I was fearless. I was always fearless with other people's money, never with my own. And then in 1995, after having been at Jiva for 14 years, the Oslo got into serious, serious trouble. And Brad Wallace, who had been an actor with the company for years and years and years, he's 38 years with the company, called me and said, would you come back? And I said, well, in the proper conditions, I would come back. And he said, well, what are those? And I laid it out. You know, I wanted full charge. I didn't want to have to deal with it. And I wanted to be back on the university payroll, which I was. And so I sent my resume to him. Interesting story. He took it to Carolyn. She was on the board.
Wow.
Now, we knew each other, but we knew each other as professional colleagues. You know, I knew who she was. I knew her parents, even though they were gone, I knew her parents very well because they were major supporters of the theater back in the 60s and the 70s. And so she took it around because I was gone for 15 years. So many of the board members did not know who I was. So many people in town knew who I was, and so many board members did not know who I was.
Right.
And she said, this is the guy you want to hire. And they went through, I guess, 150 names and wound up with me.
So she got herself a husband.
She got herself a husband. Yeah, exactly.
Very smart.
Exactly. Actually, it wasn't that simple.
No, it never is.
No, it wasn't.
No, it never is.
It wasn't. And that's how I came back in 95 when we were $2 million in debt and closing our doors and all of that. And
you did it again.
Well, it was, you know, I knew if I had enough time it would be okay. The question was time. But I had an alternative plan. See, I knew that I was going to retire in Sarasota.
Very clever of you.
I knew that.
Mm-hmm. So you worked your way back, kind of.
So I thought, if it goes, I'm here.
That's right. And if it doesn't, you're here.
If it doesn't, I'm here. Either way.
Yeah.
So 11 or 12 years later, I finally retired.
And here you are.
And here I am.
But I know you're not retired.
I am retired from running a company. I will never do that again.
Yeah.
I never realized. I loved every moment. All my career, I loved every moment of what I did. But the day I retired, we took a month-long cruise, and I came back. And I realized when I came back and we walked through these doors and I got up the next morning that every day had been stress.
Yes.
Every day.
Yeah.
And suddenly...
Free.
You know.
Free at last.
All I became was the honeydew man, and that was good. But I am, you know, freelance directing and have been doing that steadily and enjoying it and continue to do it. And we travel in the summertime and, you know, life is good. I don't think I can totally retire from doing what I love, which is directing plays.
Yeah. And you don't have to.
No. But that's really the way my career went. Inadvertently, no plan, just looking at interesting challenges, doing it.
Well, for the most part, it seems to me like you got on a track, you know, and you stepped on, and it took you so much of the time.
It's interesting, if you really want to psychoanalyze it, I didn't want anybody else to be in charge of me but me.
Yes.
When you're an actor, you're at the mercy of someone sitting across the table watching you do your thing and saying, she's too short, he's too tall. And when you're rejected, it's hard, and you have to justify that by saying, well, I'm not the type he was looking for. You never can say to yourself, I'm not talented enough.
Right.
You know, it's a hard life, an actor's life. A director's life is even more difficult because someone has to come and see your work. As an actor, you can audition. But as a director, someone has to come and see your work. If you're running something, if you're running a theater, you can hire your wife, you can hire your daughter, you can do whatever you want.
That's right. You know, this is very consistent with being the prince.
Yeah, probably so. Well, my mother drove me to success, but she died very young.
How old was she?
She said she was 49, but I think she was 51. It was very young.
Was it very difficult for you?
Yeah. I was married, I had two kids. But it was very difficult. I was very close to her. As Jewish boys are with
That's
their mothers,
right.
You know. I was
That's
very
right.
close to her. And I would get very angry at her when I was growing up because she was so demanding.
Yeah.
But
she gave you
she gave you
all the skills that you then used in your life.
She gave me survival skills.
Yes, she certainly did.
She did. She gave me survival skills.
Yeah.
And that was important.
Well, it's essential. Really, you've done everything. Is there anything else you'd like to do?
Not really.
You don't want to write.
You know, I want to write my memoirs, and I started to write my memoirs for my grandchildren.
Yeah, yeah.
For my grandchild, I should say. I only have one grandchild. And then my computer crashed, and I lost it all, so I haven't gotten back to doing that. I haven't written that much. I've written just a couple of things. But I'll get back to it. I will. And this summer, I have an 18-year-old granddaughter who lives in Chicago. I've watched her grow up once a year when she came to visit it. I was always too busy to go there because I was working. And she's very bright. She's just gotten a scholarship to DePaul University. Lovely, lovely, beautiful girl. And 2 years ago, I said, Jessica, for your graduation, Carol and I are taking you to Europe. That's what we're doing this summer. And I'm so looking forward to bonding with her.
Yeah. And having her learn you.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wrap up. Is there anything that you would want to say about yourself, about the theater? About
if anyone could be in the place in life that I am right now, they would be extremely content.
It's very lovely. That's very
I would
lovely.
Wish on anyone the place that I am in right now.
Me
with
too.
With a beautiful marriage and a great life and still active and still doing what I want.
A history you're proud of and a present that
a
you love.
A history I'm proud of, exactly. And a present that I'm absolutely relishing. So,
mazel tov.
Thank you. Thank you.
So there is Howard Millman wishing us all what we all wished for ourselves. A history that we're proud of and a present that we relish. And maybe we can't all undo the past, so maybe we can't all have a history that we're proud of, but as they say, today is the first day of the rest of our lives, and so we can begin to create the past that we're going to have right now. And we can make that something that we can be proud of by relishing the present. And of course, that's part of what I'm trying to say, that instead of focusing on the goal, looking ahead, where do I need to be, what should I be doing, all that, that we can be looking at what we are doing and relishing the present as much as it is humanly possible. So one of the ways to do that is not to yell at ourselves or criticize ourselves or beat ourselves up. And one of the ways to do that is to recognize why we're not doing things we might think we need to be doing. And in this show, I'm talking about how the potential danger, even unseen potential danger, unacknowledged potential danger, can get in our way. And I'm going to close the show by talking a little bit more about that. But before I do that, I want to say yet again the biggest of thank yous to my intrepid IT guy, Josh Hackney, who, without whom, I'll tell you, he downloads things from YouTube for me so I can use them on the show. If it can be done electronically, Josh can do it. I just call up and I say, well, what about this? What about that? And Josh says, sure, we can do that. So, you know, you can get a hold of Josh by listening to any of my shows in which I am constantly giving his information, going up on my website, The Lynn Show. God, did I give that? I wonder if I did. Anyway, it's thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. You can email me and ask me about Josh or any old thing. And so now I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about danger, and then I'm going to close the show. Take a minute. Consider the idea that there really is a danger attached to the change you want to make. When you think about this change, do you feel anxious? Is there a queasiness in the pit of your stomach or tension in your jaw or your shoulder muscles? It isn't necessary to name the danger to recognize its existence. Even if you can't identify a specific danger or isolate the source of your anxiety, even if you think it's silly to suspect an unrecognized danger, consider the possibility that making the change that you want to but can't make scares you. You may not accept the idea that some nameless threat can keep you from doing something you want to do. The suggestion that fear of danger is stopping you may even make you angry. You know, culturally, we disapprove of avoiding anger. We call that cowardice. We label fear a weakness. Our fear of fear is so big that a deodorant manufacturer chose the slogan, "Never let him see you sweat," as the basis for their national campaign, using a bunch of celebrities who proudly reported that they pretend not to be afraid in situations where anyone would certainly have the right to be afraid. We've all seen the movies in which heroes bravely and often single-handedly court and defy danger. We have a great deal of support for denying our fear, but no role models for accepting and dealing with it. Expressions like hang tough help us talk about courage, but our vocabulary for describing fear, it's insulting. Yellow, sissy, chicken. Our culture applauds the individual who struggles against impossible odds. Our country, that is the United States, was theoretically founded on the premise that the weak will prevail against the strong. Even Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, she proved that the small and meek could outwit Oz, the great and powerful. We're all subject to a potent cultural mythology that encourages us to deny our fear and ignore any possible danger. That mythology tells us that if we recognize the danger, we'll cause it to happen. If we admit fear, we'll be incapacitated, and that difficulty guarantees growth. I love that. It's so absurd. Do you believe any of these myths? Because if you do, you may be trying to force yourself to make a change just because it's tough or scary. You may have focused all of your attention on the benefits that you expect the change to bring you, but denied the possibility of danger. And if you did, let me assure you Ignoring danger will not make it go away. Recognizing danger will not make it happen. Admitting that you're afraid won't incapacitate you, and difficulty will not guarantee growth. On the contrary, ignoring danger, denying fear, trying to do something you can't do, that all guarantees failure. And failure, as we all know, rather than advancing you, will set you back. The ability to deny fear will keep you from feeling frightened. But as long as you pretend that danger doesn't exist, you won't be able to take your particular danger seriously. Recognizing your danger will help you prepare for it and allow you to appreciate, I repeat, appreciate your ability to protect yourself by avoiding it. The notion that protecting yourself by avoiding danger is something to be proud of, that may be a new concept for you. If you were raised, as I was, in this no guts, no glory culture, you may be ashamed of your ability to keep yourself from danger. But your self-protective reflex to avoid danger is instinctive and natural. It's responsible for keeping the species alive. Our cultural tendency to condemn our natural instincts is one of the things that makes it so difficult for us to trust ourselves, to search for who we really are. You will be more likely to make the change you want to make when you can trust that you're acting in your best interests and give up the impulse to second guess or criticize what you do naturally. So, are you thinking about danger? Thinking about what might be getting between you and what it is you want to do? Yeah, are you thinking, there can't be a danger to what I want to do? After all I want to do is lose weight, or all I want to do is make my kid clean up his room, or all I want to do is buy a new dress. I don't know. But what I do know is that if it's something you really want and you haven't been able to do it, one of the things that stops us is a potential danger, and that this culture is really uninterested in that. We're a goal-oriented, show-me-the-money kind of culture. We're interested in results and not in process. Unfortunately, human beings are all about process, not necessarily about results. I was speaking to a group last week, and I was saying what I always say, you know, if there's something you want to do, there's an obstacle getting in your way, and figuring out what the obstacle is one of the ways to help you do it. And this woman shaking her head vigorously, and she raised her hand and she said, oh, I agree entirely, and I really want to lose weight, and I don't care why I can't. And I said, well, thank you for making my point. The problem is that if the why I can't is a danger, she loses the weight and her husband, who has always been happy to have a not very sexy wife who nobody looks at, now has a sexy wife who other men look at and he doesn't like it. Oh, I could go on and on with the dangers about losing weight. So if there's a danger and she hasn't acknowledged it, she's not going to be able to lose the weight. So I encourage you to think about the change and what the danger might be, and I'll talk more about that in the following shows. But now all I want to do is say thank you, thank you, thank you for being here. I will be here again next Tuesday at 1 o'clock on the Radio Ear Network, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. The ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten